everyone, and welcome back to A Pint with Peter, an informative and somewhat comedy podcast where me and my friend Chris sit down with my dad and we try to bridge the intergenerational gap. Now, Dad, I come here tonight with Jimi Hendrix blasting from the front door, and I'm sat in front of a Jimi Hendrix shrine. Yeah. So I think, Chris, we might be chatting about Jimi Hendrix.
This is where I worship. Put it on for a minute, Russ. What shall we have? Let's have Machine Gun.
See how we get on.
Are you guys both okay in this difficult and trying time?
You're making do.
I was making do.
I was on to the energy company the other day, but all fine.
Oh, good luck with that. Bloody hell, it's just insane. Has he got enough volume on that?
Chris is the volume guy.
Yeah.
Glad it post-production.
Right.
Probably not. The Hendrix estate is rubbing their hands.
Yeah. I'm going to title tonight's episode Midnight's Hippie Children. Because I think it, as I've told you before, I think it, in some ways it was the end of the hippie dream. This concert with Hendrix, it was the end of something. Anyway, let's be contemporary. So here we go again. Let's together subvert normality. How does that appeal to you on a Friday evening? Subverting normality.
I like it.
You like the idea? The other thing is, well done. I mean, we're into our 60s with these podcasts. Who'd have believed it?
I know. A little drunken conversation between me and Chris became 60 episodes.
Wow, incredible. I mean, it has been a couple of weeks since we last recorded. But what I find really amazing, I mean this quite sincerely, I mean, under normal circumstances, you know, had we been doing this in, I don't know, 2002 or 2009, yeah, I wouldn't even have this introduction because nothing in the wider world would be happening, would it? But, oh no, Ducky, chaos is the new norm. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah.
It's just the new norm. And what I like to do is to actually record this. So, you know, when I'm dead and gone, you can play it back and say, oh, yeah, that was the time. You know, you've had Ms. Truss, remember her?
Mm-hmm.
Just about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to talk, if I get time, about numbers tonight. So I want you to have it in mind about your favourite number and so on and so forth, yeah? I mean, I call her Liz of the 44 Days because, I'm a massive Notts Forest fan. And Brian Clough, if you know your footballing history, he went to Leeds United and he lasted 44 days.
Yeah.
Yeah? Did you know that?
No.
Anyway, bad, mad history, isn't it? I mean, the Tories after that, I know you like scandalous incidents. I don't know if you can bear to even watch TV or listen to the radio. I know when I was working as a therapist, it was one of the first pieces of advice I gave to people. You know, just cut down your listening to bad news because it will kind of infiltrate your soul, won't it?
Oh, yeah. That's why I avoid it. I used to have classical FM on my drive to work.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, but then during my drive, the news would come on, so I've stopped it now.
What about you, Chris? I mean, do you limit?
I do limit. I also think sort of like some people go too far the other way.
Oh, and avoid it completely.
Avoid it completely.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it makes them ignorant to the world around them.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, people of my generation, it was almost an expectation that you stayed within the news cycle. Of course, a massive difference between when I was younger and now is you've got a 24-hour evolving cycle, haven't you? Which makes it difficult. But the incident, I don't know if you saw it, you know, the Tories needed to retool. And did you see it? The chief whipper in the, you know, they have to lobby, they have to go and vote and so on. This guy was going, he's pushing people, he didn't get into trouble for it. I'm fucking furious and I don't give a fuck anymore. He was pushing his colleagues.
I've heard about this.
Did you not watch it? So here we are. Our 61st tilt, this is, I think. Am I right? 61st?
61.
Jesus. Which is actually a Hendrix song.
Oh.
It's called 61st Wedding Anniversary, I seem to recall. So I know some people like listening to these song references, don't they? So what we're going to do tonight, we're going to, of course, chew on some flavoursome cultural tidbits because I think this Isle of Wight Festival was a cultural event. I'm hopefully going to forget all about Liz Truss and co. I mean, do you think we, at the moment, are potentially surveying the rubble of the British economy? and you know, having trashed our reputation internationally. Do you think it's bad? I chatted to half a dozen people yesterday, and every single one of them I said, do you think this is a really serious crisis? And they all responded, yeah, I really do think it is. So what do you think?
I do, but as someone without a mortgage and a saver,
interesting.
Because yeah. Interest rates are going up.
Yeah, Sever is a silver lining
for me, but like I said, I'm not a mortgage holder. I don't own a house.
Well, luckily we've got all those locked in.
You have to get a lodger, Russell. Yeah. What sort of a lodger could you have? Would you have somebody my age? Because that's a big thing nowadays, where elderly people team up with younger people. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I have seen that.
You don't fancy that? Having somebody like me coming to live with you? Can you imagine?
I want a Swedish exchange student who likes to walk around.
Yeah, they used to be called au pairs, Russell.
Yeah, that's
that thing. Yeah.
You want an American Pie experience.
Yeah. Anyway, the new old Chancellor, predictably nuked Lizzie, and then you had Quasi with his mad economic plan. Did you follow that? I know. Let's make the pie bigger. Let's give loads of money away to the super rich. Did you get that?
Oh, no, I remember that.
Absolutely deranged. And now, I think it's a cheap shot to be critical of politicians, particularly in terms of their personality and looks. But I was listening to B.I.G., you know, the rapper. It's probably dead now. It's probably being shot. Do you know the song?
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking, Richie, Richie, Richie. Do you know this one? Richie, 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 can't you see? Sometimes your words just hypnotize me. Do you know
that one? Yeah.
I just love your flashy ways. Guess it's why we're so broke and you're so vain. What do you think?
Very good, Dad.
Do you think he's going to make it? Or are we... I talked to Andy at the weekend, and the Americans are really into this.
Are they?
Yeah, I said to him, is all this bollocks being covered where you are? And he said, yeah, big time. It's really big news.
Yeah,
and there's one, I can't remember his name. He was claiming that Brits are fearful now of being taken over by rich Indians. Can you believe it? He was lambasted for it. So, you know, here we are, lads, in the smoking ruins of dear old Blighty. I mean, what I really fear, I don't want to be cynical, but I think you will ultimately have some social disorder.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no violent mobs yet. What are we on? 61, 62. So place your bets. Maybe we could have the riots as a special feature. I'm reckoning on podcast 70. What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know if we're too pacified now.
No, I don't know. We've not hit winter yet.
Yeah.
All right. It's a bit like Game of Thrones then.
It's going to be, depends what happens with energy, doesn't it, over winter.
I'm just curious to know what's going to be the match. You know, like what's going to light it. I think it'll be something really small, like the World Cup gets delayed by a week.
Something really trivial.
Yeah. That's what will push people.
Yeah. Or it could be dog related, couldn't it?
Or maybe Prince Andrew with the corgis.
Yeah. Oh my God. Oh, don't mention the royals to me. Jesus. I mean, what you've got now, it seems to me... I mean, one thing Andy and I were discussing, because he's got a really good sense of history, is in the end, you just wonder how powerful and influential politicians and the governments of various countries actually are. Because in the end, and it was proven this time, it seems to me that when Quasi came out with this plan, the markets looked at it and said, no go.
Yeah.
No way, Jose. And then they completely jettisoned it and caused massive problems, didn't they? Do you know what I'm saying? It seems to me that there are powers, forces at work that are much more powerful than legitimate governments in a way. And if they don't like something, I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
I was going to say it's the Illuminati.
We are now a conspiracy theory podcast.
Wow.
But if the big banks and investment firms don't think they're going to be able to make money on stuff,
they've got the clout, haven't they? Yeah. Never mind, lads, anyway. I think we've covered contemporary history. I mean, hopefully we'll be here next time. Let's get back to the revered Reverend Jimmy's Sunday service. Do you remember? Barney and I had kind of infiltrated right up to the front. And on the last podcast, you played that Silver Waterfall song, didn't you? Amazing Grace, remember?
Oh, yeah.
Remember we heard that Amazing Grace and we went herring off. And there was a little hiatus. And then suddenly, because back then the staging was very bare and everything. I mean, we were up near the front. I mean, it seemed to me as if he was kind of being encouraged to go on stage, you know. So he slumped onto stage very nonchalantly, and just to paint a picture for you, they're a three piece, obviously one of the loudest, best trios I think ever in rock pop history. So Jimmy kind of got himself in position. He was on the left wing, by the way, you know. Yeah. I like football.
Yeah.
So Jimmy on the left wing. You had the drummer, who was Mitch Mitchell. He was centre back. Yeah, he was centre of stage. I don't know if you've seen pictures of Mitch Mitchell. Quite a lanky guy, all arms and legs, which a lot of drummers are. So you got to picture him. He had shoulder length hair, bearded, and as you can see, I never had one because I think it's a really shite fashion. People used to wear headbands back in those days.
Oh, first of all, you've had beards.
Yeah. So
yeah,
you've got there, guys. You've got four not particularly great Hendrix albums, and on how many of them is he actually wearing a headband?
Three.
Yeah, that's right. Three out of four. Yeah.
Oh no, two.
Yeah, two.
Have you known anybody who's a bit of a headband wearer?
Yeah.
Have you? Bloody hell.
Yeah, it didn't look very cool.
Wow.
But he was more of a metalhead.
I've known metalheads that were.
Yeah, I feel like it transferred into metalheads.
So do you think that was a bit of a kind of passing fad?
I think it depends.
I remember Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
I think Axl Rose had a kind of head thing going on.
I feel like it depends on the person. I feel like he's still wearing it now.
Oh, my God. Because what came after, because I know you like your fashion notes, guys. What came after, you obviously had the kind of bandana around your head, but you had that kind of head covering, like a gypsy pirate thing. You know, the pirate kind of thing. Do you know anybody who had that sort of thing?
No.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? I'm holding up a wonderful book. It's called 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. And I'm open at the page for the very first Hendrix album, which was incredibly, it was 1967. I was only a kid. And that was called Are You Experienced? And there's a publicity photo of the time. Yeah? And it shows Hendrix standing godlike behind two bare-breasted women, isn't it? And the other two are kind of standing on the sidelines looking. I mean, can you imagine that nowadays?
It would be quite controversial.
You'd be in trouble, wouldn't you? I know we talked about the 16 nudes on Electric Ladyland, but, you know, just giving you a cultural reference point, I mean, that wouldn't... I don't know, that wouldn't really have been given a second glance. So there he was. He had a black bassist, which is interesting. The bassist, as I told you before, was Billy Cox, and Billy Cox went right back to Hendrix's army days. Before they played this gig, the Hendrix trio was actually all black, yeah? The drummer was black. Obviously, you had Billy Cox and you had Hendrix himself. And it's quite interesting. When you came in, I was playing an album called Band of Gypsies, which came from that period. Billy Cox was there that night. He was... I think when you have a front person, and I think it causes a lot of trouble, the other individuals, the less kind of coveted individuals, they take a kind of background role, don't they? Have you ever seen that in bands, where you have a front person and the others are fundamentally anonymous, aren't they?
I think it's common throughout most bands. Mm. That the lead singer is always the well-known one, always leading the interviews.
I mean, others could be just anybody.
Oh, yeah.
If you look at David Bowie.
The Spiders.
Yeah. So, like, no one really remembers them.
Interesting.
I mean, obviously, with my music knowledge, I thought he was a soloist and just would have random people.
The one I remember is Mick. I don't want to go off on a Bowie tangent. The one I remember is Mick Ronson. You're quite right. You're quite right.
I feel like they almost need a gimmick.
Yeah.
You know, the other band members to maybe make them stand out.
But what I'm driving at here is you can almost guarantee that in a lot of bands, ego, the size of the ego, is probably as big or even bigger than the guy who holds the limelight. And that's where you get these tensions between bands. I mean, the classic for me would be The Police. I mean, The Police, do you like them? Did you remember their music?
No, not really.
Yeah, I mean, they were three really egotistical guys, and they would fight. They literally would have fist fights.
Fight for us, Metallica. They're quite famous, aren't they?
Yeah.
For hating each other.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
suppose it's quite well known that they won't talk to each other, go out on stage, play, and then leave.
Because you could have a whole series of podcasts, couldn't you, on brotherly love or brotherly hate? You know, where you've got family members who play together and they all hate each other.
Is that in reference to...
Well, it's obviously Oasis and so... Hey, you're digressing, Russell. You must stop it. Anyway, you get an idea of what Hendrix looked like. I mean, Billy Cox, the bassist, was just wearing... I seem to recall him just wearing purple. You know, had a pair of purple flares on and a purple top. The drummer, because the drummers are kind of back from the act anyway. But Hendrix looked absolutely amazing. I mean, he had his afro and he had that wonderful... Like a kaftan. Multicoloured, and he had a choker. Have you ever had an era where anybody's worn a choker? You know,
yeah.
Kind of female type jewellery.
Yeah, like with our generation, it was the more girls.
Yeah.
Once again, maybe goths, metalheads.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Can't say I ever wore one.
No.
So there he was, and he slumped on. And what's interesting is, I definitely heard him. He said he mumbled, because he was a mumbler. If you hear him talking, he was definitely a mumbler. And what he said was, I ain't come. Remember it distinctly? I ain't come. In other words, he was either A, half asleep, or B, drugged, or... I don't know, kind of somewhere else in his mind. And I mean, really, but the whole gig, I think he was up to a point just going through the motions. Have you been to gigs like that, where you feel they're just, it's a kind of couple of steps up from cabaret?
Yeah.
It's a great gig, but...
I think we touched upon this last time where I said, when I saw My Chemical Romance, he came out clearly intoxicated and... Probably played half an hour and didn't do an encore.
Yeah. I mean, you could talk about that all night. I mean, you see, the big thing is, if I don't want to be mystical about it, but that night in the rain and in the darkness, I mean, he was actually performing, if you want, the last glorious rites on a farmer's field, the legend, very self-absorbed. And do you know how many songs he played? You wouldn't know. 18. Yeah, he played 18 songs. And I mean, I'm not getting into pseudo mysticism here, but do you know how many days he had left on Earth?
18.
Yes, you've got it. Yeah, spooky, isn't it? But if we have time, I'll get onto this later, because I've got a lot of material around Hendrix. You know, you could probably get a shelf full of stuff about him. But if you, even at my modest level, scan through his life, he also, I'm not sure he's into numerology, but if you look at it, the number 3 and the number 6... And obviously multiples of 3 and 6 came up over and over and over again. And one of his best known songs, which was a great movie, by the way, was on, it's called If 6 Was 9, yeah, which is in the movie Easy Rider. It's a great clip. If you ever get a chance, watch that clip from Easy Rider, If 6 Was 9. Do you know the song? Doo-doo, doo-doo, doo-doo. Do if all the hippies could have played. Yeah, another one, to check it out. It's a really good song. We'll play it later. But there they were. There he was with all his personal problems and business pressures and exhaustion. And boy, it showed. It really did show.
And was he still entertaining to watch?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
But what I found, you know, with hindsight is it's almost, he was such a virtuoso player. It was almost as if the instrument was playing him. Do you know what I mean? The music and the guitar playing was kind of divorced from the human being playing it. Do you know what I mean? I think you're into really interesting territory there, because you're talking about the relationship between the artist and their work. Do you know what I'm saying here? It's because often you can have, particularly nowadays with wokeness, you can have an artist. It could be a poet. It could be a painter. With painting, take Picasso, for example. With poetry, take T.S. Eliot, for example, as their biographies, autobiographies have come out, you begin to realise that as people, surprisingly, they had really dark, often quite unpleasant aspects to their character, and yet they were able to produce really sublime work. You with me? I think philosophically it's a really, really interesting area. And even that night, I had a feeling that Hendrix, you know, the body, the physical body of Hendrix, it was almost like a conduit, like a channel for the music. It was almost as if he was being channeled from somewhere else. I think that was a vibe, an aspect to him that, if you want to be cynical, was visible commercially. Do you know what I mean? Because obviously in that business, you've got to create an image, haven't you? And you've got to create an image that will basically sell records. Yeah. And I think he had that side to him. Even though his, you know, performances on stage were incredibly flamboyant, etc., if you read all the stuff around him, he was a very quiet, gentle, fairly shy guy. Which again is a really interesting aspect of performance, isn't it? Because often you look at people. I don't think Bowie was one, actually. I think Bowie was quite extrovert anyway. But a lot of really out front people are actually quite quiet individuals, aren't they? They find expression in getting up on that stage. I mean, is there anybody you like? Who, you know, although they're very extrovert on stage, in real life they're quite introverted.
I think a lot of comedians are like that.
Do you?
Yeah, they're quite introverted. And also it touches upon that thing within them, that kind of maybe some darkness within them.
I think so. I'd hate to be a comedian, because imagine everybody who meets you, they're going to say, make me laugh. Well, they are, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're going to, you know, say something funny. It must drive you frigging mad, mustn't it? I mean, with the song, he used, you know, for your guitar freaks, he used various instruments. So for some songs, he used what was called a flying V. Have you ever seen people playing those? That was in a V shape. And normally it was just his Stratocaster. So he came on. When he performed at Woodstock, I've got the triple album there on the shelf. He gained, if you want, worldwide notoriety, particularly in the States, because at Woodstock, he played a guitar version of the Star Spangled Banner. Yeah, because in the States, unlike here, the national anthem, all that kind of stuff, they salute the flag in the morning, and don't they? Chris will maybe tell me I'm wrong. I mean, that's the impression.
I think so. I think they still do, I'm not sure.
He tried his first number. He tried to emulate it. He tried to do a version of "God Save the Queen," but it didn't go down very well. And he kind of just.
I was going to say, was it met with boos?
No, not at all. I mean, I've mentioned it before. It's a kind of little piece of social history, and it probably would sound really weird to you guys, but. When I was probably definitely into my teens, when you went to a cinema, at the end of the evening, when the movie had finished, the national anthem played, and you were expected to stand up, and you were expected to stand there until it finished, and then you'd file out the cinema. I mean, does that sound really bizarre to you?
It's
ridiculous.
I'd walk out.
We used to, but it was a kind of faux rebellion, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it doesn't have the significance it would have to an American. So he then launched into Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, yeah? Because he, like a lot of artists, he would is very, very indebted to Bob Dylan, for example. Quite a number of his songs came from Dylan.
I mean, was covers quite a... Yeah, like now you get a lot of bands doing covers of other bands.
Oh,
was
absolutely,
that a
thing
even then?
Yeah. I think even Hendrix. I mean, all there's four albums there. I would say half the songs haven't been penned by him, or the derivations or interpretations of blues songs and so on and so forth. He then went into Spanish Castle Magic, which is excellent. I mean, the audio. He's obviously got some planning in there, because he started off quite, you know, very slowly and melodically, and then gradually built it up. But it didn't come to any kind of a crescendo. You with me? It was as if he was kind of a bit bored with it. My favourite, he played Machine Gun, which was the track I was playing when you came in. It has all these... It's a wonderful soundscape, and if you close your eyes, you can imagine. Don't forget, it was the time of the Vietnam War. You know, the machine guns firing and the gunships flying overhead. And so on. Then he kind of drifted off into a blues song called Lover Man. And then, you know, you were into what, the fifth or sixth song, you could tell he was hiding it, getting pissed off because of technical difficulties. Are you with me? Have you been to a concert where that's happened, where the sound is rubbish, or, you know, they break strings or whatever?
No.
Okay, right, just shows how maybe there was a kind of element of, I wouldn't call it amateurishness, but maybe...
I feel like now you constantly see...
Oh, yeah, the
members,
crew.
...members, like,
crew.
Swapping
yeah.
guitars between each song. I don't know if you've ever noticed that,
yeah.
Corey.
They'll play one song, swap the guitar, swap back to that guitar.
Yeah, and I mean some of the stuff comes from my favourite album actually, which is Band of Gypsies, which came out after his death. I mean, all those four albums you can see there are various record companies cashing in on his reputation. I mean, a lot of the stuff that came out after his death is absolute rubbish. They just found any old crap that he maybe would have done many, many years before. Do you know what I mean? Just put it out there. The album, if you ever look through, that I really like after he died, was Cry of Love. It was called Cry of Love, and was a really good song. It's called Angel. You know, people read things into it in Angel. Part of the lyric is he imagines his spirit flying over London town. Do you know what I mean? I mean, people read a lot into that because obviously he died in a fairly squalid death in London. And at this time, and this is where it gets interesting. You know, I've said to you before, only on a few occasions, I've witnessed in a small way various events. I was in London, for example, when you had what was called the Grosvenor Square riots. That was around the American Embassy. Yep. Mm. Somebody actually died then, but that's by the by, tragically. But if you actually are, even if you're on the periphery of an incident, and you know what you saw, and you know what you heard, and then you read reports of it afterwards, it's quite amazing how you can get many, many different accounts of the same incident. Because what I remember, probably into song 6 or song 7, you looked up and above the staging, there's like a massive tarpaulin, like a canopy. And it's fucking on fire. It was literally on fire. And the band didn't even seem to notice. And then...
Was it on fire?
Oh, God, yeah.
How many substances had you taken?
No. It was definitely on fire. And when you read articles about it, it kind of doesn't make a big deal of it. But it was quite a big deal. And if you take the trouble to watch the DVD of the concert, it's quite bizarre. The organizer, while Hendrix is still playing, or the MC, he came out with something like, "We have a fire on stage. If anyone in the arena has any means of bringing water, can you please..." Do you know what I mean? That's amateurish.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like saying, "Are any of you firemen? If you are, come and help us." And the band just kept on playing, and there's this massive conflagration briefly. Apparently what it was, according to Mick Farren, remember Mick Farren? You know, Fun City. According to Mick Farren, somebody thought it would be amusing to let off, these marine flares you get, and shoot it up, but it instead of shooting up into the sky, it hit the roof and set fire to it. But I found that, to me, what I'm trying to say to you guys is, for me, it was really emblematic of the age. You know, where people were either A, so dozy, or B, so stoned. You could be looking at what now would be a major kind of critical incident and just, "Oh, look, the stage is on fire. That's a shame, isn't it?" You know what I'm saying? It was a kind of nonchalant, that kind of casual hippie kind of vibe. You know, "Oh, man, stay cool. Nobody's going to get hurt." You know, just...
Something that comes to mind for me is a popular thing now in festivals is mainly the lead singer will climb the rafters as a thing. Was that a thing back in your day? Because I think it's that cool factor going on to what you said, like, "I don't care, I'm going to climb this, get shit later."
To be honest with you, and I'm trying to get over to you, I think a major difference, even with very, very lively acts, let's say like The Who, people were quite studious in their appreciation of the music. You know, even for quite, you know, pounding, pneumatic, lively music, you know, you kind of stand there and shuffle a bit and nod your head. You know, it wasn't the kind of thing. You didn't have a mosh pit or anything like that.
I was going to say, would they come about around the punk era?
Ah, well, it's one little piece of...
Jumping ahead to your podcast here.
One little piece of history I didn't mention. The front of the stage. You can check it out on the DVD. You had several rows of deck chairs, would you believe?
Very nice.
Was that where kids would go?
No, there's no kids there. Well, interestingly, there were very... I don't recall any kids there. But the first four or five rows were deck chairs. There were lines of deck chairs there, like a bloody concert in a park, you know, in a bandstand. Anyway, the fire kind of died out and the band played on. Yeah, we played a couple of funky songs. We played Dolly Dagger, Red House. And his blues playing was absolutely incredible. I don't know if it's because of the fire, but they finished more or less with a song called In From the Storm. Yeah, so it could have been a firestorm. Because funnily enough, one of the best Hendrix songs is actually called Fire from their first album. And it just fizzled out. He, you know, he played his 18th song. He kind of mumbled a thank you. And then basically thanked the audience for being patient. And he didn't throw his guitar on the ground, but he basically dropped it in disgust. and he walked off. And that was it. That was the classic Hendrix concert.
It kind of reminds me of when me and Charlotte saw The Prodigy at Leeds. They literally say, finish something like Firestarter. And just went, bye, and walked off.
Is that right?
Yeah, kind of almost like an anticlimactic ending, because we were like, oh, are they going to come back on? And no.
It's almost like the Possessed. Yeah. Playing, and then they come out and go,
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Oh, touched on it there, Craig.
I mean, I'd love the experience of playing. I think what happened ultimately with the pop scene that I remember and the rock scene, I think it became quite jaded and I think it became quite matter of fact. And critically, from starting off watching bands in literally sweaty clubs and, you know, walking around on beer-stained carpets, you went, the people who were making money from it, you know, the producers and the entrepreneurs, you started getting bigger and bigger, bigger venues. And as the venues got bigger, the audience, instead of having a kind of intimate, nice gig, it would be very depersonalised and alienating. And I think that led ultimately to the demise of this kind of rock scene. I think people got fed up of it.
Well, everyone, just like Jimmy finishing his set, we are going to finish the podcast there this week. And with the end of Jimmy's performance, it also brings our chat about the Isle of Wight Festival to an end. We really hope you've enjoyed that insight into the past. Next week on the podcast, we will sadly be touching upon the death of Jimi Hendrix and how, in a way, it links to the end of the hippie movement. I've quite enjoyed this chat about the Isle of Wight Festival, and me and Chris actually watched the documentary my dad has on it, and it's left us wanting more. So we are reaching out to you, the audience. Do you have any stories from it? Or even better, some photos. Please share anything you might have with us by heading over to our Twitter and using the handle @apintwithpeter, or use our email apintwithpeter@gmail.com. And remember to review the podcast on whatever platform you're listening to us on. It just helps the podcast get noticed. Thanks everyone for listening. Please stand for the national anthem, and on to the next one.